Hello there, Beard here. So good evening, handy viewers, such as you are. There we go, contractually obliged, getting out of the way earlier. And welcome to this rather exclusive, in a way, discussion with sometimes approver and boss of mine on another podcast I do, Mr. Sherwin Matthews. Hello, Sherwin.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. Very well, chap. Yourself?
I'm at least reasonable. Don't worry, I won't keep the stupid voice up for the entire time.
No, the sort of projection of the stupid voice is my thing, as anyone that speaks to me in real life will question. Just very quickly before we dive into all of this, your number of hats that you wear at Steamforged seems to be ever-growing.
I don't like sleep.
Whenever I speak to Steve on this podcast or to Jamie, it's been very easy to go, this is what these people do. But Sherwin, what is it, for those people that might not know, what is it that you do at Steamforged Games?
So I am Steamforged Games lead writer, and I'm also a games designer.
And project manager on Resident Evil and...
I wouldn't like to say that. I do work with a lot of the project guys quite a lot. And obviously I'm lead designer for Resident Evil, or Resident Evil 2, I should say. But it's something where I work hand in hand, but I would never take away from what those guys do, because there's no way I spend all my time emailing China and various other places to try and get things sorted. But I do work very closely with those guys. So yeah, it's safe to say my workload has increased somewhat over the last couple of years. But it's good. I like being busy.
Excellent. The many-hatted Sherwin Matthews. And congratulations on a very successful launch of the Resident Evil 2 board game recently.
Yeah, thank you. It's really been received extremely well by the community. And honestly, the sort of part of me that first played this game, or about to release the secret that I played it when I wasn't old enough to play it, but a thousand years ago when I was young, and I played it and thoroughly fell in love with it. The part of me then, which must have been 17, 16 years old,
right?
Like, he thinks Sherwin now is the coolest person in the entire world. Right? I literally had a passion project, and it feels really, really, really good to have worked on that. So, thank you.
Yeah, it is very important to impress our 16-year-old selves. Mine would be highly, highly disappointed, I think. But there we are. So, somewhat out of the blue, we find ourselves in a position where four guilds have new captains.
A little bit.
Surprise. Well done, first of all, keeping this under wraps, because this massively came out of left field. I did not see this coming, which is lovely. Now, before we sort of delve into each of the four captains that have been revealed thus far, and I think it's important to point out, you know, we're not going to go through a card read in this podcast. I'm sure other people are chatting to Steve, to Bryce, to DC, to Jamie, or whomever about the rules specifically. Why I wanted to talk to you, Sherwin, is I want to focus more on the story and the sort of the tales that are coming around both behind these four captains and also the sort of Guild Ball in-game community as a whole. So is there... I'm assuming at this point, and I appreciate this may or may not be something that you can confirm, that every major guild will be seeing a new captain. Please don't answer that.
I like the way you're trying to pin me down.
I'm trying to do the opposite. I appreciate that this is information that will or will not come at another point, but either that or these four guilds suddenly have a massive advantage over everyone else.
We do like playing favourites, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Union had three captains for a while. Why not these?
There you go. In all seriousness, you know that I'm not going to answer that one.
And I'm not posing it as a question as a result. But is there any reason why these guilds in-game are suddenly developing additional captains?
I think it's the idea in-game in terms of actual sort of overall lore arc, no. Mm. But one thing we can certainly start to look at with regards to what our background for Guild Ball is with regards to new captains is we can really get this sense that it's almost the dawn of a new era for Guild Ball happening around about now. The Free Cities draft is the most obvious thing I could think of, which kind of really pushes that forward. Purely because we're now starting to see this shift away from kind of like the old guard, where you have people like Ox, for example, or Obelboss, or whoever else, and they're kind of, these are the captains that have been around since the very start of things, and they're the first generation. And those figures are starting to fade out now forever through, knife to the throat or just retiring or whatever else. Of course, there's another great example. We're starting to see these players kind of fade back, and there's this sense that, the new generation is going to step up and take over, which is sort of something that leads into this kind of brave new world almost, or this evolving sport or what it is, because that's the other thing that's starting to happen now, which we see with the Free Cities draft, is we now start to have this, we've got our first football academy where people are actually going to learn how to play Guild Ball. They're not going there to learn how to fight or to learn how to fit into a guild. They're now learning the sport itself, and even the rules of the sport, how it's placed. You've got it. How the sport's played, the conduct, that sort of stuff is starting to be more shaped now. And I think that's really what a lot of these captains represent, a sort of look forward to what that might be, or at least a very much a new beginnings, if that makes sense.
That makes sense. I mean, we have that great speech by Honor in the eponymous episode where she pretty much says, you are at the start of something new. This is a forefront. I wish I could be in your shoes and do this all over again, but I'm not. This is all now down to you guys. So that sort of speech isn't just hyperbole from a long established character. It's genuinely the case that Guild Ball has massively turned a corner.
Exactly. You've got it.
And I remember at not the last SteamCon, but the SteamCon previous, where we were talking about, I think Barry from the Roll Better podcast had asked you about Faris and Judgment, about why is this okay? Yeah, and to which the simple answer was, well, there's nothing in the Guild Ball rulebook that says you can't have a horse on the field and escalation is a thing. Are we also looking at a similar situation where there's nothing in the Guild Ball rulebook that says you can't have multiple captains? Is that something that we have perhaps put on the game?
That's an interesting one. I'd imagine. I mean, the simple fact is that in our world, anyway, I don't see why not. Is the obvious answer to that? But I think the simple way of thinking about mechanically is more so much a captain is just another figure on a team. In truth, it's not like you have that one superhuman and then sort of four grunts and a mascot. It's more so much that captain is supposed to fit is. Got to their position is just a more spectacular or more trained or more practiced or whatever way you want to go to individual than perhaps the other members of the team. So that in the game mechanics obviously represents them having a better, they are more powerful pieces on the table.
Sure.
But in terms of our lore, there's no reason why you can't just see them all as veterans. And, I guess from sort of a ordering your team around the pitch mechanic, if you had two captains, it's slightly awkward.
Sure. Okay. So let's sort of delve into each of them individually, and I want to start with veteran captain Boar, because as soon as I saw those combination of words, I was absolutely blown away. I'll be honest, I love the idea of this. Boar for me has always been this sort of threatening, quiet shadow to Ox, and certainly right up until the season 3 story where he walks away from Ox. Do correct me if I'm wrong, you wrote it after all. So how has this suddenly gone from a man that seemingly was very happy to play second fiddle to stepping into the limelight as a captain?
I think the crucial understanding of how Boar works is that he's always been this very simple, very direct kind of character. He is a berserker. He is literally filled with just this murderous rage most of the time.
Yeah.
And he has this sort of low animal cunning to him. And in Boar's head, it's very much this sense of, the strongest should lead. I should be the one. I should do this and everything else. But at the same time, he's also canny enough to realize, I don't have the pull within the guild to actually get there to do that. Mm-hmm. Certainly for a long period of time anyway. He's not had this sense of, this sense of, I can't pull strings with any of the sort of, the elites, the magisters and the chamberlains at my guild to get to my position where I need to be. So although I'm the strongest, although I'm physically the most adept here, it's not going to work. And of course, the flip side to that is he's kept in check an awful lot of the time by the Master Butcher, by Ox, kind of, you know, being that figure, that kind of alpha dog that just kicks him back down again whenever he gets unruly. Because ultimately, Boar's not necessarily a coward, but he does know not to mess with the Master Butcher.
Fair.
Fair. So we do have that in the first season. Now, obviously, when Ox goes away, that all changes. And there's this uneasy tension between what we then have with Boar, who kind of falls in behind the next kind of alpha of the pack, which is Brisket, and competes against Philip. But by the time we get to where we are now, there's been an interesting switch in that the Master Butcher is back, Brisket is now gone, and the Master Butcher is actually taking a lot of time out and almost forming his own little clique within the actual guild itself, which Boar is very much not a part of. And the interesting dynamic we have here is we can look at Boar and say, well, is Boar just a puppet that the Master Butcher has put in place, you know, with his own connections, that, you know, this guy could lead the team out into the pitch a couple of times? Can we look at that from a perspective of, but the Master Butcher's really the one pulling his strings, or he's allowing him a little bit of leash to kind of go wild on the pitch, start killing people?
Yeah.
Can we look at him by comparison of, actually, Philip has got other things going on with her? She's had to step back somewhat, sort of fade away a little bit from leading, and now she's letting Boar step into that sort of vacuum and hoping to kind of create this new rock or this new kind of bastion that's going to butt against Ox, if that makes sense. The thing we have with the Butcher's Guild is it's very much this tension between two alpha dogs. Effectively, you've got Philip, who's definitely a leader amongst her team, appointed by the guild, and then we have Ox, who also has his supporters within the guild and has this incredible legacy within the actual amongst the rest of his teammates as well. Now, he doesn't seem to want to be captain, which is why it kind of works an uneasy truce at the moment, but you can imagine if you're Philip, you're always looking uneasily across the aisle and going, I want more supporters here, I want more backup.
Help.
And one of the way, well, not so much help, she's a very strong individual, but more so much, you know, you want allies if that was all to go off. And she can see, you know, she's not stupid. She can see that, like, Lane literally walks straight onto the pitch and immediately gets yanked into the shadows by Ox. And like, no, you're not practicing everybody else, sort of thing.
That was a really interesting thing in the Lane story in the epilogues of the Free Cities draft, is that Fillet and Ox, certainly when it comes to training the new blood on the Proving Grounds, almost seem to be working in concert. Yeah, it almost appears that balance, that sort of agreement between the two, as nervous as it might be, certainly appears to be working. And Boar was certainly one of the ones I was most curious about. Is if everything seems to be working, how has this then happened? But that certainly makes a degree of sense that it's a case of Fillet bringing people into her cause to protect herself against perceived threats.
Yeah, even if it's not necessarily something that she does need to be worried about, you can imagine that the paranoia is certainly there. Especially when it's not just, you know, we know that Boiler would probably side with the Master Butcher if there was another rebellion. Mm-hmm. We certainly know that, we also know that, you know, Boar is a maybe. Shank, I mean, we know he's been shoved off to the cooks, and we can revisit that again and think, well, is that a specific political maneuvering by Philip?
And he certainly not very happy about it.
You've got it. And then, of course, the other character that sort of recently stepped into the Butchers and immediately kind of joined up and signed up with the Master Butcher, of course, is this infamous character called Gutter. So he's kind of got a very strong core already of kind of this sort of cadre of people around him. So actually, the appointment of getting Boar on side for Philly isn't necessarily the worst idea.
That makes sense. I mean, is that so? We've seen a degree of that in the Brewer's arc in season 4. Is that a theme that will be running throughout the stories we go through, the sort of splits within the guilds into various cadres?
I don't know. I think that it works on an individual basis depending on which guild you're looking at. The Butchers, again, as we've seen, they're very much this hardcore kind of... They're almost like an old soldier troop kind of thing. They're almost an old regiment of these battle-weary soldiers. And they've obviously... The way they understand things is very, very martial, very kind of, you know, lead by the strongest, that sort of stuff. Then we have another guild where perhaps, say, the Masons, for example, where it works in a very different sort of way, because it's more about kind of individual ability or kind of who's the right person to lead at the right time, that sort of stuff. So I think for some guilds, yes. For other guilds, not so much.
Fair enough. Is there a... It's just a completely changed tack. Is there a story behind the eye patch?
There isn't, but I think purely because I think they're... I think, well, one of it is a great visual. It's the thing that came to mind when we were spitballing ideas about how this player could look, and you guys will probably remember, I'm going to earn my geek cred here, is an old Star Trek movie, where there's a Klingon character who I believe might have been played by Christopher Lloyd, but I might be wrong on that one because it's a very odd casting for a Klingon. But basically, he has like this metal plate bolted into his head eye patch, rather than actually wearing an eye patch. And that just seemed exactly what you would have with Bohr. If Bohr has to wear an eye patch, there's not going to be, I'll wear an eye patch. It's going to be bolt the thing to my skull because that's the way I want to wear this thing. However, I see this. I have written something about this, which is that it's an injury he incurred from the Master Butcher.
Right.
So at this point, you can decide whether you feel that that's something which is, you know, incurred in his initial struggle with the Master Butcher when the Master Butcher returns to the guild, or we can look at this as to whether it's a more recent injury. We don't know.
Fair enough. I love just looking at some of the mechanics and how they sort of reflect on the character as a whole. One of the things I've noticed throughout this, or in a couple of places rather, is sort of messing with the traditional ideas of influence. I love the fact that Bohr has this. He brings four influence, but only can use two himself. It just gives this really nice idea of, I'm going to carry on doing exactly what I've always done, but I'm going to shout at you to do more stuff.
He's not a leader. Simply put, he's not a leader. He's a terror. I can happily tell you, having played a game last night, he is terrifying. Literally terrifying to see on the opposite side of the pitch. However, he's not a leader. He's not sort of, you know, inspiring great confidence in the rest of his team. He's just this homicidal maniac still who wants to just murder everything in the room.
Yep. And presumably with that bloodlust aura that he's got on his back of card, that's spreading that influence, showing the way is spreading to other members of the guild.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, success follows success, right? If you see this lunatic charge into the enemy and sort of, you know, just decimate them, that's the stuff almost of like, that's almost this fantastic kind of, and a lot of Bohr's abilities are very cinematic in terms of how they actually work on the pitch. It's almost that glorious charge. You can imagine them, you know, the cleaver held up in the air, reflecting the sun, kind of swoops down and he just screams chop chop, and they'll just charge into the enemy.
Yeah.
And literally just start literally tearing into them straight away. It's very cinematic for what Bohr is. He's a lot of fun in many ways.
It's quite funny just sort of looking at that bloodlust and that chop chop ability, and I started reeling off players on their lineup in my head. It's like, I'd hate to see a bloodlusted boiler, and then it's like, I'd hate to see a bloodlusted gutter, and then just the list never stopped. It's just like, there's no one on that team I want to see affected by bloodlust, just because it's horrible. And then just that simple idea of what does a berserk striker look like? That's going to be absolutely phenomenal to take a look at.
I mean, I would, I think, honestly, I'd leave this one to Perkins and Bryce.
Yeah.
That's the better judgments of character. But I know from experience that Shank is a big winner with veteran Bohr. Shank is they're all scary, but Shank certainly adds something.
Yeah. Yeah, perfect. All right, moving on from the Butcher's Guild to their sort of polar opposite from the very early days of Guild Ball. You may have to help me with the pronunciation here. Is it Yukai?
Yukai.
Yukai. So we see another Numenasi player coming across. Love the artwork on this. And this is certainly a... just reading through the stats and through the character abilities, this one absolutely blows me away. I've no hope of ever being able to use them properly because that's not, it's not like, it's not my play style whatsoever. And I look forward to hearing Connor's reaction when he reads this card. But where have they come from?
So Yukai is, from a lore perspective anyway, so back to what we were saying about how the world is sort of really changing and adapting to Guild Ball now, and Corsair is definitely one of those old veterans. And The thing that Corsair has seen in the Fisherman's Guild is this massive change since we first saw him in season one, when he's captain of the team and they're kind of the holding, you know, they're the reigning champions and they're going forward and, you know, they're starting their campaign, and suddenly disaster strikes in the form of a butcher.
Mm.
And we have Corsair horribly maimed, kicked off the team. And at that point, it really triggers his downfall, especially, well, not his downfall, but certainly a very big change in his life. You know, he goes from being this guy who's on top of the world, leading his team, to now, you know, relative obscurity, hanging out with a bunch of pirates in this far-flung sort of island nation off to the Far East.
Mm.
And I think while he's gone, there's this real transformation in the Fisherman's Guild where, well, you know, Grayscale's kind of steps in, but isn't terribly good at leading. And we know that Shark isn't at all. Is much more like, I'll step in if you need me, but yeah, I'm not that figure. I'm not that guy. I'm not the person who could lead us to championships. I'm the guy that you give the ball to, and I just score lots of goals, and hopefully that's enough.
Yeah.
And so when Corsair returns, the first thing he realizes is, well, actually, there's a lot of damage been done to not only the, you know, not only the Guild Ball team by these two figures who aren't really able to lead it properly, but also the actual Guild infrastructure as well. We look at kind of, you know, De Laurentiis has been assassinated. We don't have a current Lord Chamberlain. You know, the Guild's floundering somewhat. We've now got the Navigators have been able to sort of, you know, politically maneuver themselves into that gap. And obviously, there's this definite resentment with Corsair about that. He definitely doesn't get on with Windfinder or the other Navigators, thinks that they're opportunistic, thinks they really kind of, they're jumped in and they're kind of exploiting the Guild, which to a certain extent is true.
Yep.
So, and one thing that is constantly at the back of Corsair's mind is, well, you know, I got keelhauled once. You know, I'm running around the pitch being who I was, and I can lead as much as I want, but all it takes is a lunatic with a cleaver and I'm out again. And this, is this idea that I want to leave a legacy.
Right.
So one thing that he's certainly got, and he obviously wants his team to be able to succeed once he's gone, and he doesn't know when that will be, the sooner the better. And we kind of have this thing where he goes back to where he was travelling amongst the Numisai with Sakana, and kind of has this memory of finding these incredible coves and these natural spots of beauty amongst in Numa, amongst the islands, where obviously there'd be bolt holes for the privateers to go hide or whatever else. And he would see these figures like Yukai kind of sitting on the edge of like the shore or whatever, fishing for hours and hours and hours in this great tranquility, this sort of really beautiful, picturesque kind of locations, and realize that these are masters of their art. They are literally characters or figures who would just sit there, and all they do is fish, and they know everything there is to know about their particular art, about their craft, to the point where it actually ceases to be kind of a trade and becomes almost like an art form.
Right.
So when Corsair is really looking at, oh, how do I influence people like Angel, or even Knuckles, we now have coming in, how do we make sure these people go on the right path to where we want them to be? The answer is, well, we look to the past, and we look to this great sense of accomplishment that exists there, these masters, and bring them forward so that now they can influence the new generations, and that way we can maintain our traditions, our strong, and we can build a very, very strong, healthy platform for the team going forward. And that's really what Corsair's looking to do with Yukai, is introduce this player as a almost, I'm not going to say like a youth coach, because that's not strictly true, but as we talked about how Guild Ball is expanding and changing, There's certainly capacity to have a second captain who's kind of more the captain who sits down and perhaps like in some sort of similar to the NFL, almost like a special teams coach, almost sits there with the younger players and sort of says, you're the future. Let's play a lot with you, work out different tactics. You know, takes Angel and Fathom aside or whatever, and obviously sits down and works with those guys, or, you know, Knuckles as well. Any of the younger generation off go with Yukai, so that way they can then learn how to play a different sort of game to everybody else.
And it's going to be fascinating, because just the cinema of their abilities is insane. just the amount of things for moving, for break the surface, for moving enemy models around, for swelling mortars, for moving their own around, which of course does tie in very nicely with Hag, another model that has a certain aesthetic connection to Yukai and the historical, the geographic connection. I love the fact that everyone from Numisai appears to carry their entire world on their back, which I love. And Cormorant's Calling and Beating Over Water, all just, it's been really interesting over the sort of the development of season 4, and a kind of, okay, I can see how the takeout game is developing. I can see how the sort of the generalist approaches, but what about the specialist for football? How's that going to change? And apparently it's going to change by being batshit crazy and just like just house of flying daggers all over the place, which I like, which is why I say I love the idea of this model. There's no way I could ever use them properly because it's just not my approach. But it makes sense, therefore, why Corsair has gone, you know, all about legacy, all about sort of trying to put his own stamp on the Fishermen's Guild and the ensured continuation of the Fishermen's Guild. But conversely to that, why has Yukai left their existence as this master fisherman on the other side of the world, travelled west, presumably, to play Guild Ball?
It's a good question. I mean, I imagine that for Yukai, it's perhaps more a sense of, well, maybe I can influence the new generation. Maybe it's dissatisfaction with actually the guild itself the same way as what Corsair has. Mm. Maybe it is something where Yukai looks at the team and thinks, well, I can make a difference here.
I want to have
a stamp as well. We should be more. Exactly it. Okay. And I think this sense of new beginnings is definitely most strongest, I think, perhaps with Yukai more than any of the other captains. This real sense of this is a new generation, this is a new dawn almost for my team.
Excellent. So whenever we've played, which hasn't been often, but you know, about once a year, it's usually been against your hunters.
Yep.
So it seems only reasonable to move on to, I love the aesthetic of this model, this is absolutely insane, to Steeljaw.
You say that, you wait till you see the actual model itself, it's beautiful.
Oh really?
It's wonderful. Yeah, excellent. It's so good.
Absolutely just festooned in traps and animal skulls and ribs and bones and this incredible primordial savage look to the model. One of your favourites, has this got the hand of Sherwin on it by any chance?
Yeah, a little bit. I was we all got to have our stab at designing different models in the early steps. Nice. We kind of sat down and we kind of divided the marks amongst us and went, yeah, let's all design some models and see what we get to. And I got Steeljaw.
Nice.
So at least in the early days, I'm not going to accept anywhere near all of the credit for a lot of development because a lot has been done on Steeljaw since. But the original concepts are certainly something I came up with anyway. And a lot of that was because, as any of your American listeners will probably tell you, and certainly those who've been to SteamCon US, there are a second tribe of hunters that we have not yet explored in our world. And we've talked about them, certainly in the lore for Season 2. Well, obviously, we're all very familiar with the hunters of the north in the Great Forests.
Sure.
Yeah, this very nomadic kind of tribes of these more traditional kind of Western hunters, that is the best way of describing them. You know, lots of animal furs and pelts, lots of kind of... Sorry?
Hearn. Just that very hearn-like aesthetic.
You've got it, exactly. Yeah, we've all seen that kind of thing. Steeljaw is one of our hunters from the far south. And the hunters in the far south don't roam the forest, they roam the great deserts. These incredible, sprawling, barren wastelands where the primordial world, it's interesting to use that word, hasn't ever properly receded away. So they roam, because in the dawn of when we have our timeline for the Empire of the Three Cities, I'm going terribly too far in depth now away from captains, but to explain, we have this, there's this sense that great beasts roam the land. We have this, you know, the land is... There are some humanity, and it's obviously in these tiny, isolated settlements, but we don't necessarily have any real sense of safety or any sense of community because these people are forced to basically live that way because great beasts roam the land, these towering monstrosities of scale and teeth that literally are just ferocity that will just murder anything in their path as they rampage around.
Dinosaurs. Now,
yeah, to give it a name. At this point, we have this sense that the very early sort of statements, very early stages we have, and I believe we referenced this in Season 3, it might have got cut out and ended on the editing room floor, but the Shadow Council, which first formed, charged the Hunters Guild, or the Hunters, who then became the Hunters Guild, with, okay, eliminate these great beasts so we can exist here.
That's pretty much
the thing that happened, except obviously the hunters then did this and then receded away to the great forest. Well, for the other hunters, the others pursued the creatures, the beasts that escaped to the far south. And the idea is, obviously, since mankind flourished in the space created for them, and we end up now where the Empire of the Free Cities actually is. Mm-hmm. But in the far south, the great beasts have never truly been eliminated. They still roam these massive plains. They're still brought down by the hunters. It's still this conflict between the hunters and the great beasts is still alive and well down there.
Gotcha.
And Steeljaw is one of those hunters. In fact, a very infamous one.
Okay.
She's this fearsome hunter where, she kind of walks, you imagine this cinematic again, we've talked about this before. She sort of crests this dune, kind of walking above it, all these traps just leaving a trail behind her.
Yeah, she does seem to have a cloak of bear traps just trailing behind her, which...
Yeah, exactly.
Very cool.
She's not really a hunter that's perhaps worried too much about kind of stealth or about being too obvious, mostly because it's a dinosaur. It's huge. The point is that her real trade is trapping these things as best she can, and obviously finding chinks in their armor, kind of finding a weak point that she can then get into to actually hurt this giant incredible beast. And that's really where Steeljaw is coming from. And we have this idea that if Steeljaw arrives on the edge of your settlement, for the sort of isolated settlement you have in this desert wasteland, and sort of turns up, everyone knows, okay, that's the time where we pack up our stuff and leave, because the reason that Steeljaw is here is because there's prey coming for her, and that's the thing we're worried about. So much like with Yukai, we have this sense of, why is Steeljaw coming now to the north? Is she looking for new allies because she knows a huge migration is coming? Is there going to be some awakening that's going to happen of some great beast that's been perhaps slumbering under the surface of the ground or something? Mm-hmm. Is she perhaps here because she's literally just killed as much stuff, there's no more challenge in the self, that she doesn't have, that she's now looking for something new?
Right.
There's a deliberate mystery to go on with Steeljaw that we don't know why she stepped forward.
Excellent. And there's one, just to reiterate a point, this isn't a card read, this isn't a discussion of the rules, but I can't help but notice one thing within the rules of Steeljaw, and that there is no blessing from either the Sun Father or the Moon Goddess. There is no indication of affiliation to that sort of druidic culture that the hunters have always been associated since their introduction. Is she there for just not part of that druidic culture? Is that druidic culture... only centered around the northern part of the Hunters Guild? Or is it that she just has no truck with either of these gods and does her own thing?
Pretty much that. I think you still have, certainly for Steeljaw and a personal sort of level, she just simply has no truck with the gods. They're no use to her. In terms of how the desert hunters or the southern hunters would understand the Sun Father and the Moon Goddess would be very different to what we have in the druidic culture of the northern hunters, though. And they'd have different roles. Now, it might well be that Steeljaw has some sense of belief or something, but not enough certainly to influence her main roles.
Interesting. Love the idea of a captain that interacts with traps. Love her playbook. Absolutely crazy. The idea of just traps springing up from the pitch all over the place is fantastic. I'm really glad to see that Cena can't put traps down, because that would be mental.
That one got ironed out in playtest.
Cannot imagine why. That'd be hilarious. Although, you just fill them up with a basket of them and watch them shake off.
Yeah. The interesting thing that Steeljaw has is one of the things we looked at with these captains, and Yukai kind of bucks the trend on this one for a reason we'll go back to in a second, but we wanted these captains to be very user-friendly for new players. We don't necessarily, necessarily mean they're simplified or they're streamlined or they're, dumbed down or anything. Mm. It's more so much we wanted it to be something where, a new player could sit there, pick up this model and go, oh cool, I love this thing, how do I use it? And they don't then have to sit there and struggle to kind of work out how does this work, I have to make sure I'm within the range of this, or what's the best player to take or anything. Boar is perhaps the best example of this. You put Boar on the pitch, he's this whirling dervish of destruction, just point him at the enemy and you'll have some fun with him, you'll have all sorts of fun playing with him. Steeljaw feeds into that a little bit more. The hunters generally tend to be one of our slightly more complex guilds, but one of the things we looked at with Steeljaw in terms of how to simplify things is this new type of rule, which is an always-on kind of ability, which is that while Steeljaw is on the pitch, she gives out a bonus to the rest of her team. There's no range on that, deliberately. There's no range on that, purely because it makes it very easy for, what's easier for a new player than having to measure range? Well, actually, how about just have it on the pitch?
Yeah.
And it gives your opponent, obviously, great a great way to kind of counterplay against it, because just eliminate that player. Neither of the two players we just mentioned are terribly tough. So if you can take out Steeljaw, then suddenly the rest of her team, they can't use traps. Well, unless they've got the game, they've got the rule inherently, but they don't have the ability to put out different traps. They don't.
They're not going to do weak points. They're not going to do bleeds. They're not going to have these fantastic additional effects. It almost reminds me, in a way, of the season 3 plot card that gave you additional influence for killing a captain. I forget what it was called, but there is with both of these folks, there is a real incentive to removing them from the pitch. Or in my case, putting them in a box, because your opponent's just not going to have that advantage, which is, let's be honest, quite considerable. I love how also Steeljaw in many ways reminds me of Veteran Honor, in that sort of repositioning of traps, in the same way you had the repositioning, of harvest markers. Really, really interesting to see a captain interacting with what. Well, it is now their guild rule. It's like a principal core mechanic of that guild structure. So absolutely fascinating to see how that would look. But also the model, the story, utterly fascinating. Very much looking forward to seeing Steeljaw on the pitch. Excuse me. Right, I have purposely left one till last.
No, we don't need to talk about this one.
Terrifying little Victorian girls. Always an excellent place to start. Correct me if I'm wrong, Sharon, but have we seen this lady before?
We spoiled this one at Christmas time.
Mm.
Sneaky though I am, we spoiled Morn, or the Mournful Child, as she was first seen.
Yes,
a very long time ago, months ago, in fact, a whole different year ago, and. And yeah, you guys all saw that, and we even described the Mournful Child as the future.
Oh my god! And we all ignored it.
this is why nobody trusts us.
Yeah, this is why no trust you, Sherwin. You.
Yeah, just me specifically. Everyone else is cool, just not me.
Yep.
Yeah. No. So Morn is. We thought we'd be pretty sneaky with that. We thought we'd throw that one in there for you guys. I mean, Morn is so much fun on the table. Like all of these captains are incredible fun, but Morn is really, really, really fun. I don't ever want to play Perkins while he's using Morn. there's that look of glee that he has when he's kind of when you have just no chance during in the early game. And he's kind of Morn is super fun, and I think a lot of the design principle that went into Morn, we kind of started out with, well, the other two captains for the Morticians are very much super solos. They've definitely got this sense of they take a lot of influence and they do everything for the team.
You put a big stack on them and they get stuff done, whatever that happens to be.
So we looked at Morn and went, well, how about we make a player that buffs the rest of the team instead?
Yes. And having let's be honest, she's immortal if she wants to be. Like, you don't ever have to take this model off the pitch. Again, I love the 4-4 influence cap, that, she really is a coach. She really is someone that's going to try and get the players around her to do stuff. She's Garst's new best friend, quite frankly.
Kaska as well.
Yeah, Taxet. Well, there's a whole bunch of people are like Memory and Kaska. I'm just like, I could do with Tax 7 versions of Memory. with the 4-long playbook, that's a happy place for me. Empathy on Garst for just the ultimate nope of but again, I don't, as much, I could quite happily wax lyrical about how excited I am for this young lady's rules. Hey, rerolls, everyone likes rerolls, let's have more rerolls. Just insane. But what I'm curious about, what I want to ask you about, is where has she come from? Is this Obulus is doing? how does this fit in with Skelpel?
I'm strongly going to refer you to go back to the story which we introduced her with. She's already had her backstory. We already saw around the... what did I call it? A Free Cities Tale, I think it was
Free
called.
Cities Carol.
A Free Cities Carol. Of course it was. Because we even used the first paragraph from A Christmas Carol.
Really?
There's lots of things. As much as people occasionally find things that I wasn't aware of in some of the writing we have, there are lots of things which perhaps get missed. But
nice.
Yeah, if you read the first paragraph of that story and then read the first paragraph of A Christmas Carol, we changed the names and a couple of the words to kind of make it better reflect how English is written now. But for the most part, that's the opening part of it.
Very nice. I'm ashamed to say I missed that one.
It's okay. You're probably not necessarily a Dickens kind of guy. I don't know. But anyway, the point being that we introduced Morn there, and Morn was described by Obulus's shade. Oh, he used his proper name. Obulboss's shade as the future.
Yes.
Now, all we now know is that the morticians have this mournful child has turned up to the guild and seems to have the massive amounts of backing from the Lord Chamberlain and from the other magisters and from the elites of the guild.
Okay.
And seems to have just effortlessly stepped into this very influential role within the team. Even though, obviously, it's, you know, she is a small child. She certainly doesn't bring much physical presence to the pitch.
No.
And it's this thorn in Scalpel's side of, I want to get stuff done, and I realize I'm not the cap. Yeah, I'm not really the captain here. Like the whole thing of what Scalpel was looking to do by murdering Obulus was, I want to step into the role. I want to become, I want to be the captain. I want to go forward. And of course, you've now got this frustration of, not that Scalpel originally didn't realize the sort of extent of power that Obulus held over everybody else, but it's more so much. Obulus has always been this captain who's had much more mobility, much more influence, and much more agency within his guild than the standard guild ball captain.
Mm-hmm.
If we look at, for example, season one Ox, where it's very much you're a hatchet man, we tell you what to do and you go do it. Obulus has never had that limiting him whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. And it's certainly what you were saying in terms of the agency of Obulus that I think really came to the fore in the season four story, that meeting with Brisket. Sort of that nighttime rendezvous really set him in a very nice way of exactly what he does. But I have so many questions about Morn, about why her eyes have been replaced by metal discs. Why does she seemingly have the guild symbol emblazoned on her forehead? Is there...
Well, the discs are the ferryman's coins.
Yes. Yeah.
To be very specific.
Which is traditionally a symbol of, you know, this person is dead and moved on. You're not going to answer at all. Fair enough. So what does this mean then for the Obulus Guild, showing my true cards there, for the morticians going forward, is that sort of internal civil war between Morn and Scalpel, is that coming? Or rather between Scalpel and the Lord Chamberlain of the Guild?
I think at this point it's more a sense of frustration that, you know, Scalpel realizes exactly the role and the influence a guild ball captain has, and that's very different to what she's seen with Obulus. And I think that's something where we're now going to see where that frustration kind of leads Scalpel to. Is it something where it's kind of, oh, throw my hands up in the air, I can't do anything, like, I've become captain but I'm a puppet, you know, I wanted to become the puppet master, I'm still a puppet, just now I'm dancing to Morn's tune? Is it something where, okay, so now I got here by killing the person before me, do I now have to kill this ghoul that's appeared? That's one we're deliberately going to leave for you guys to find out as we go forward.
Fair. Also, there's that sort of indication within the Gilboa Carol story, which, whilst it had the highly amusing tags, is it canon, is it not canon, or words to that effect, where there's almost been that accusation by Obulus's shade that Scalpel has stepped away from her Spirit Weaver's past. By murdering him, she is no longer that sort of observational role that the Spirit Weavers have had in the past. So will there be a degree of recourse or a degree of sort of separation from her own traditions?
Well, what I think is very interesting that we see in the Three Seats Carol is that we see the shades that normally surround her having abandoned her. And we see that Ghast, for example, has left and moved on to a different character now. There's a degree of whether we wonder whether this is the beginning, perhaps, of the end of Scalpel as she was before, and she's actually moving away from her roots and moving away from her past into some other role, or she's somehow become less than she was before by murdering Obulus. She betrayed some concert that she was never supposed to, that was always supposed to be there. We don't know with the Scalpel character where it's going yet, and of course, one thing I kind of, I guess, that we did talk about earlier, you mentioned it, and we kind of can feed back to is, yeah, if she does decide that she wants to try and kill Morn to gain power, how do you kill an immortal?
Yep. Because she certainly seems to be.
Exactly.
I cannot wait to get her out on the pitch. I am very excited at the prospect of Morn. I'm very interested to see how the community reacts to these bombshells. I'm very interested to see how the OPD changes now that some guilds have three captains and others have two, or in fact, if it changes at all and people have to leave one behind. So a phenomenal sort of bombshell from Steamforge and yourself there, Sherwin. March and especially Vengeance are now going to be very, very interesting places. Thank you very much for spending the time with me this morning. And
no worries.
Thank you. Yeah. Cheers, chap. Much greatly appreciated.
Thank you.
So that was my interview with Sherwin over the newly announced four captains and the storylines centred around them. I will be going through the cards, their mechanics and their impact on the game as a whole with my usual co-hosts, Mr. Connor Rooney and Panzer Harris, very shortly on this feed, where they will have absolutely no idea what they're about to talk with. Gentlemen, from the past, may I apologise? I have kept this from you purely to hear your reactions. Ah, oh, this ought to be good.